Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Mahamudra Class, Part 5.
All right. How are you doing with Mahamudra? No answer came the stern reply. You have a microphone for Joe, please?
I'm finding it quite fruitful, as a matter of fact. And I wanted to check my thinking on one thing, my understanding on one thing. So far, we've been investigating three different ways of practicing.
You better remind me.
Not thinking about the future, past, and present, yep. Shortening it. The verbs escape me at the moment. But. Basic practice.
Primary practice.
Primary practice.
Yep.
And the one you gave us last week, which was no distraction, no control, no work, which I found the most problematic. Because it's harder to catch something when it comes up for me with that formulation.
The instructions distracted you, and you really had to work at it, and you couldn't.
Well, as long as I could control it, it was fine.
Yeah, so, no problem.
The part that tripped me up was no distraction, because I immediately thought that I was supposed to be distraction free. And then I came across a realization that maybe the meaning is that there actually is no distraction. I mean, even distractions, if followed, being awake to distraction, if you're awake to it, by distraction, in that case, I meant movement of mind. So there actually is none if you're awake to it.
Okay.
Which seemed to be more fruitful again. Because it led me back to being present to whatever was happening.
Okay. Anybody else? Claire.
Remember 15 years ago, we read Thich Nhat Hanh's book. I really can't remember which one. It was one of the first books.
Being Peace or...
It was the one about washing dishes. If you wash dishes, I'm back to that thing of doing one thing.
Yeah.
My world is very small. If I swim, all I... know, see, hear, is going through the water, and I see the sun on the bottom of the pool, and I feel my muscles, and I swim. That's all I do.
Okay.
And I don't have, I can't do the whole world in my little world.
What is the whole world?
I don't know. I mean, I know there's a war on because I read the paper.
Ah.
And I know people kill each other. I'm not so happy about
it. You didn't hear about the ruler of the universe.
Huh?
You didn't hear about the ruler of the universe, did you?
I can't.
You didn't hear about the ruler of the universe, did you?
The ruler?
The ruler.
The ruler?
Of the universe.
I never heard about him?
You didn't?
No, I never heard about
him. No, you missed that. You didn't listen to the tape either, I bet.
The ruler of the universe?
Yeah.
Was that last? That was 2 weeks ago, right? Thanksgiving week. Yeah, you should listen to that recording. It's very important.
The ruler of the universe.
Yeah, we should call it the ruler of the universe. Pardon?
The ruler of the universe practice.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I know. You missed the most important lesson. You missed it. You missed, you know, everybody got enlightened that day. Everybody got enlightened that evening. Okay. What is your world?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
My world is very small. It's
no, that isn't. That tells me how your world is. We don't know that yet.
My world is what I see, what I hear, what I smell,
right?
What I taste,
okay?
What I feel,
mm-hmm.
And the thoughts that come into my head.
Okay, is there any other world than that?
Not in my world. Not in my experience. I mean, there's a war on, but I'm not in it.
That's right. You read words on a piece of page, or you may watch something on the television screen. You may see pictures. What happens when you see those pictures or read those words?
They evoke thoughts or feelings. They evoke thoughts or feelings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That is your world. The world of those experiences.
When I have it.
But you have it all the time.
No, I don't. I don't have it when I'm meditating. I don't have it when I'm swimming. I don't have it when I'm making a bed or washing the dishes. I just do one thing.
You have certain feelings and experiences when you make your bed or wash your dishes, right?
It's a small world, Ken.
Is it any smaller than anybody else's world?
I don't know what anybody else's world is.
Ah, then how do you know your world is small?
Because it's what I know.
Yes, but right how do you know it's small?
Maybe it's the universe. Maybe it's the universe.
Ah. See, you should have read about the ruler of the universe. Okay, now, when you say, my world is a very small world, you have to be thinking that there is another world compared to which your world is small.
Okay, I understand that.
What world is that?
Pardon me?
What world are you talking about?
Well, the world that I see on television or read in the newspapers.
Okay.
That evokes the feelings about whatever is going on.
And this is what I've been talking about a lot. There's the distinction between the world that is constructed out of our visual and emotional impressions, sensations, and the world that we actually experience, which is the world of sensory and emotional impressions. Okay? But that world isn't small. That's the only world we actually experience. The other world is a world that we construct, project, however you want to talk about it.
That's okay.
Okay.
It's not difficult.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Now that we have that straightened around. Raquel, how are you doing with Mahamudra here? You just come back from retreat. You should have lots to tell us.
My world's not small.
Is it on?
Yeah. Pardon me? Yeah.
Okay. Your world is not small. Tell us about your world and...
Well, the my constructed world, I mean, not the sensory world that I live in when I'm a few seconds I'm awake, but my constructed world is... I call it La La Land, but...
That's L-A-L-A, right?
L-A-L-A.
Yeah.
It's just a... It's sort of the world I want to be living in. I sort of pretend I'm living in the world I want to be living in instead of my actual world. So, for me, this practice has been good. I mean, I had been doing the primary practice quite a bit, and so I've kind of been sticking to that. And I've been mainly trying, to focus, to work at off the cushion, kind of using it during my day. And
how have you been doing that?
I set my computer to tell me on the hour when it's the hour. So when I hear that, even if I'm in the middle of whatever I'm at work, I'll do the practice for a very kind of a short amount of time. And then the next hour, I'll do it again. And then I think I kind of emailed you about this, but I've been trying to look at when exactly I fell asleep and what might have triggered that. But that's been pretty hard to do.
Happens pretty quickly, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good effort. So you're trying to, you've got your computer helping you come back periodically. That's good. Does it make a difference?
I think it does. Yeah, for sure. I'm also trying to do it when the computer's not reminding me, and between the two, I do feel like it's making a little difference, but then I still am falling asleep.
Yeah. Okay. When they first started this, I suggested in your practice that you drop into wakefulness, which, as Joe mentioned earlier, we can do by don't chase the past, don't entertain the future, don't dwell in the present, relax. And there's a shift. I drop into a degree of wakefulness. And it lasts, in the beginning, a second or two. But you keep doing it. And you gradually cultivate a relationship with that. And it deepens, and we talked about how that deepens through bringing in the insight aspect and uniting the seeing with the resting, so that when you rest, you see, when you see, you rest. Now, this is something you work at. And Joe's referring to another set of instructions. No distraction. No control. No work. You say, well, it says no work, then how can you say you work at this? Well, the This is an area where there's a lot of confusion. Because people will get pointing out instructions from Mahamudra and Dzogchen and think, oh, there's nothing to do. That's that will say itself. I don't have to do anything. And they won't do anything and nothing will happen. And they actually think that's meditation. I think we covered that last week when you were going over some of the problems or the faults, or the mistakes. Now, when you drop into that wakefulness, that's when you are practicing, actually. No distraction, no control, no work. If when you're in that wakefulness, you're distracted, you fall out of it. If in that wakefulness, you try to control your experience, you immediately fall out of it. You know, try to make it last longer, try to deepen it, you fall out. And if you try to work at anything, you fall out of that natural wakefulness. So, you don't. But for most of us, because we live very complex and multifaceted lives, we're very busy and active, so the mind is moving a lot, then we fall out of it, usually after a second or two. As soon as we become aware that we've fallen out of it, then we move back to it. We return using the same technique. That's what the work is, returning. So you have the returning and the resting, returning and resting. Now, as we do that over a period of time, we begin to stabilize a degree of wakefulness. So it may last a few seconds. Maybe it gets to the point where it lasts even a few minutes. One of the reasons people do retreats is so that it lasts for longer and longer periods, hours even. When it begins to stabilize, that's when you start no distraction, no work, no control for longer periods of time. And you actually just go about, if you can, just go about your day in this natural wakefulness. That's not particularly easy to develop that, but it's possible, and that's what we're aiming to do. What this is called is, I don't like the terminology particularly, but it's one terminology that uses, is taking hold of the practice. You're not taking hold of anything, it's just you're able to rest in that natural wakefulness. And you learn how to function in that natural wakefulness. So that natural wakefulness is there. And in that natural wakefulness, there is no distraction. You don't try to control your experience. Whatever arises is there. And you're not working at anything. Now, you say, well, how do you do anything? The strange thing is that you actually can do things. You can have whole discussions. You know, you can go for walks. You can even work at problems. That's a little more difficult. But it is very possible to do things. So, but in order to get to that point, you have to work at that, and that work is the work of building capacity. And there are many, many ways in which capacity can be built. You can use specialized energy transformation exercises, which build up the energy level or raise the level of energy in your whole system so that you fewer things disturb the quality of your attention. So it naturally becomes easier that way. The primary practice is such, one such method works, raises the level through four or five shifts, and we discuss that. One can just make a practice of whenever you recognize you've been distracted, just dropping back into that natural wakefulness. That's basically the method of the, what's called the Sutra tradition of Mahamudra. And that works fine, and many, many people have practiced it. And it's a subtle, continual effort. And that's, we're going to discuss a bit more about that this evening. Particularly, how does it work in context of daily life? Because that's where most of us are spending most of our time. Retreat situation, most of the time is spent in meditation period. So, in reading this section, this is 55, page 55, in clarifying the natural state. I became a little irritated with the translation in some places. So I want to go through this working somewhat from the Tibetan. Now, the first sentence says, "For many have taken hold of the meditation until the greater one-pointedness." There are four stages of Mahamudra, which we'll be discussing in our final class. And they're called one-point simplicity, one flavor, and no practice. And then each of them has three stages within them. You know, humans have this urge to systematize everything. It's very strange, but we do. And there's a certain quite significant shift that takes place between the last stage of one point and the first stage of simplicity, but we'll discuss exactly that next week. It says, until this point, you only have an ordinary type of meditation state and post-meditation, not the authentic kind. Let's talk about a few terms here. You have the meditation and post-meditation. They don't actually refer to meditation and post-meditation. They refer to when you're practicing in formal meditation sessions where we're practicing without mixing anything. We're just doing the practice. It's not mixed with activity. We're just doing the practice. And then in post-meditation, you're doing the practice, but it's mixed with activity. That's the difference. Now, for most people, but not for all, they have a certain experience in their formal practice or in their composure when the mind is not mixed. You're not doing any other kind of activity and it's resting very profoundly. And the term for meditation here is better translated in my mind as the word composure. It means to place in balance, literally. And when you sit for a period of time, mind balances out, it rests, opens, seeing arises, resting and seeing come together. And there's experience, there's an understanding, there's a knowing which arises. And then when you get up from that, you carry that with you to some extent. And in the beginning stages, you carry really an echo of that, or at first just a memory, then an echo. And as one's practice deepens, then that experience that you're having when you're resting actually becomes how you experience the world as you go about and take care of things and do things. So eventually there is no distinction between formal composure and what we call ensuing activity, or ensuing attainment, which is what they're calling post-meditation. Now, the reason that the differential, the greater one-pointedness is mentioned is that there's a qualitative shift in experience at that point, because when you shift into simplicity, the seeing component is stabilized also. It's not just the resting component, but the seeing component is stabilized. So your mind becomes very, very clear and very simple, and you see there actually is nothing to do, just as it is described in no distraction, no control, no work. So that's what's going on in that first sentence. That it's when you have that unity of seeing and resting that's authentic, or the right meditation. But he turns around and qualifies this immediately, fortunately. Because nevertheless, everything is meditation training if your naturally aware presence of mind does not wander while practicing. And he makes this statement that I understand what's written in the Tibetan here is that you're practicing, you're familiar, and remember we talked about meditation meaning familiarization. You're familiarizing yourself with this practice as long as you're not distracted from the basic recollection, which is usually translated as mindfulness, of this natural awareness. So as long as there's something happening there, you're practicing. Now, this makes things much simpler, because you don't have to be in a profound state all the time, which is the impression you can get from the first thing, and what happens is a lot of people just say, well, I can't do that, and they throw up their hands, feeling anything else, their efforts are futile. But my own teacher said things, he didn't use this language, this is language from a few centuries ago, but he said saying exactly the same thing as in contemporary, more contemporary language, that when you use such an instruction as Don't dwell in the chase the past. Don't entertain the future. Don't dwell in the present. Just rest. And you experience that shift. Practice is just resting in the shift. And as long as you're doing that, that's fine. There isn't anything to do. And that in itself will gradually deepen. And to practice that, as Raquel is doing, you know, having her computer reminder to, oh, forgot about that for the last hour. Okay, come back. If you can be coming back to that every few minutes, you'll find that it changes everything about your life. It becomes massively inconvenient, actually. Because one doesn't get to indulge one's ordinary reactions. If somebody says something which would normally irritate you, and you feel this great surge to be irritated, which, you know, it can be quite satisfying sometimes. But you just go, oh. Now you're just awake in your experience, and you can feel all of those experiences that or sensations which would normally move you into irritation, but you're just resting. You don't ever get that satisfaction of just being really irritated. Instead, there's a... it's very hard to describe. The closest I can say is there's a dynamic quiet or a dynamic peace. It's not that things are flat. Things are very alive and awake. But things don't disturb. They don't grab. And I think we use the quality, they don't stick. There isn't that stickiness that there usually is in experience. And coming back into that again and again and again, that is the practice. Is it making sense to you, Joe?
Yeah, I was just thinking of an example. Yeah. I was just thinking of an example of exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you feel all your energy charging down that channel, and you just, oh.
Yeah, all these alternatives all of a sudden come to mind.
But you're not going down any of them.
None of them.
No.
They're all either contradictory or empty or whatever you want to say. There's no point in
No point in any of them, yeah. Massively inconvenient, isn't it?
But restful in a certain way.
Yeah, I know.
And exactly. The consequences are much better.
The consequences are much better. It's totally irritating. Okay, so then the next thing. What he's saying here until you experience no distinction between formal practice and ensuing experience, your main effort should be in developing the composure aspect, which is formal practice. And resting with this single experience of that shift that we've talked about many times, just until you can, and stabilizing it. so that it becomes constant. Now, this is the approach that is taken in monastic training, where you have the luxury or the opportunity for things to be in retreat for relatively long periods of time. This is not the circumstances in which we practice, which is why I've been emphasizing over and over again, coming back, coming back, coming back. So the coming back becomes a constant thing, and you build up stability by coming back again and again and again. And then during the ensuing attainment or ensuing experience, to use thought and appearance, thought and sensation, to enhance your experience. Now, what does this mean? Well, go into it a bit more later, but in the beginning what it means is anytime you notice something special, like a vibrant color or a loud sound or something like that, all of anything special like that almost always triggers a natural wakefulness. Like, oh. Especially if a beautiful photograph, for instance, you go. And your mind is suddenly just more awake, just like that. So, in the beginning, you use those kinds of things and you recognize the wakefulness there and you just rest there, just as if you're doing formal practice. And so, you know, you're gone to a restaurant and you ordered your meal and you take a bite of the fish and it's really good. You go, and so you're right in that wakefulness. And as you practice that, you see, you're actually coming back. Then you're able to do it with more and more of your experience. So anytime somebody yells at you, well, that wakes you up. And anytime you feel attracted towards somebody, that wakes you up. So you're actually using what is arising in your mind. You know, and every time you see a flower or see a car or something like that, that wakes you up. So you're actually using more and more, progressively more of your experience to keep coming back into that wakeful state. And when you can do it with absolutely everything, like every thought and every sensation wakes you up, hey, no, that won't be too bad. Got it, Raquel? I think you do. Yes. Yeah. Good. Okay. Now, and skipping a couple of lines down, just after the break there, as for sustaining the essence it is taught, you should remain in the three manners, fresh, artless, and unbound. There are three ways of placing that preserve the essence, what they're saying, preserve the essence. But we could also put that into simpler language, say, that maintains naturalness or maintains presence. And they are what have been translated as fresh, artless, and unbound. And these are exactly equivalent to the instructions I gave earlier, last time. No distraction, no control, and no work. when you're not distracted, then everything is fresh. When you don't try to control your experience, here they're using artless in the sense of, it's an old meaning of art, which was to manipulate or control. You know, an artless gesture is a very natural gesture. It's not contrived. And it comes from stage productions where, you know, you try to make it very beautiful. And so it would look contrived because you were trying to do it so much. What was Aristotle's dictum? The art is to hide the art. And then... This third one is open or unbound. Well, what is it like not to work at anything? Now, several years ago, I did a 3-week Dzogchen retreat. The meditation instruction was very detailed. It was literally do nothing. And it was a very good retreat for me. As I said, it was a 3-week retreat, and so you do nothing. Well, it was good for about 10 to 14 days for me. And it was a very good retreat, because I had a lot of quite deep experience. It was very helpful in quite unexpected ways. But after about 10 or about 12 or 14 days, I started to get a little antsy. Like, I'm doing nothing. And then it's very interesting. The person who wrote the text that we were studying, it's a very great figure who lived in the 14th century, a person called Longchenpa. Well, he did nothing for 12 years. I thought of my own teacher, Kala Rinpoche, who in his mid-20s went off into the mountains and did nothing. And I began to appreciate these people in a very, very different way, because you have to be truly concerned with having no reputation and achieving absolutely nothing in your life, because you're not doing anything. And not the least bit concerned what anybody thinks about you. This takes an incredible kind of courage to actually do nothing in your life. And there's so much that has to fall away for that. So here we are, and we do our meditation periods, you know, half an hour, maybe an hour. It's really hard to do nothing for that period of time, because we get all of the stuff. Well, I'm not getting my work done. You know, oh, I've got to make this phone call. Or, you know, I've got to arrange this. You know, all of those things come up. So we can't even do this for like half an hour or an hour. What would it be like to go and do it like you're going off and you're going to do nothing for like 6 months? What would that be like? How what would you have to let go of to do that? So I'm going into this because that not working instruction means being completely unbound, which is how they've translated this other thing. So being completely open, just you're totally open. You're not trying to do anything with your life. with who you are. And this is so contrary to our social conditioning. It's almost incomprehensible. And yet, it is an extraordinarily direct path to the kind of freedom that we tell ourselves that we're seeking. So remember that when you get a little antsy in your meditation next time. It's, oh, just doing nothing for half an hour, or 40 minutes, or an hour. Stuff arises, and you don't do anything about it. It's completely nuts, but that's the path. So, the next couple of lines are wonderfully concise. It's where Tibetan is somewhat like a programming language, you know. You can say an awful lot in very, very few words. So, how I understand it is to be fresh, or for freshness, or however you want to say that, there's a key point with respect to the body, a key point with respect to the breath, and a key point with respect to the mind. A key point with respect to the body is you relax from the inside out. Now, if you see pictures of Tibetan yogins and how they practice, they sit in what looks like an extraordinarily strained posture. They're in full lotus, and their hands are, their arms are actually locked like this, so that their shoulders are raised, so the whole body is hanging from the framework, the shoulder yoke. It doesn't look very comfortable. It's actually quite a difficult posture. But what it makes possible is exactly this thing. The body is, it's a difficult posture, but it's an extremely stable posture. It's a posture in which you can actually experience things very, very intensely and not be disturbed. And I practiced it in retreat until I got ill, and then I couldn't do it anymore. So I know a little bit about how powerful the posture is. But the key point in here is that in that you start relaxing from the inside out, which is precisely why I got ill, because I ran into stuff that I couldn't relax into. And it's this relaxing from the inside out that's very, very important. So we use our ordinary posture, whether it's sitting in a chair or sitting. But the point of the posture, the point of our practice, is to create the conditions so that we can relax from the inside out. Now, that sounds very simple. It's actually absolutely terrifying. Because why are we tense? Pardon? Because
we're afraid.
Yeah. We're tense because there are things we don't want to experience. And by holding ourselves tightly, we can't experience them. But if you relax, then all of those sensations that are being blocked by the tension start to come in, come out and experience. And that's what has to happen. In this practice. So this is a very, very profound instruction, relaxing from the inside out. And it's not all that easy. It's one of the reasons why we put a great deal of effort into clearing a lot of stuff out of the way, so that a lot of the stuff that's already tight and things like that is actually cleared out of the way, so that one can relax from the inside out. You've worked through those experiences. And you do that through meditations such as death and impermanence and karma and taking and sending and the development of compassion, the four immeasurables, all of those kinds of things. And another thing that we do a lot of is energy transformation exercise, raise the level of energy so that we can actually be in a higher state of attention and relax from the inside out. And there are a few people, and our meditation director in the retreat was one of these who, he didn't get into all of that stuff. He just sat and he just let all of that stuff arise and he relaxed from the inside out. His main practice was Mahamudra. Even when I knew him, he probably hadn't lied down for 10 years. When he was tired, he just went to sleep. And then he woke up. He'd wake up and go back to his meditation. And every now and then he'd come into retreat and said, I've been dreaming of Mahakala lately. I should probably make some few offerings, but I can't be bothered. And then he'd go back to his practice. And so that's what he did. And he was... He's a very good person, not terribly articulate, but when he talked about his experience of mind, he was very articulate about that. Because he was so intimately acquainted with it. So when you're sitting, you sit in a posture which allows you to relax from the inside out. And if you find yourself encountering very, very deep-seated tensions and fears associated with them, don't be surprised, that's part of the process. And what do you do with that? Well, absolutely nothing. You let that all come out. There's ways to do that more skillfully and less skillfully, but the image that I found very helpful is to feel that all of that stuff is like a flower bud. And the quality of your attention is like the sun. And when the sun shines on the flower bud, then the bud opens quite naturally. And it just opens. If you try to open it up by tearing the petals at it, it doesn't work so well. Which is how a lot of people approach their practice. So this means being willing to, and having the patience, and so forth, to just sit. In a state of attention, and that's where the non-distraction comes from, and let whatever needs to unfold, unfold. And that's basically what one's doing in Mahamudra. And, you know, Dzogchen and Shikantaza, which is the Zen equivalent, and so forth. But the essence of all of them is relaxing from the inside out. Associated with that is the key point with respect to the breath. Which is, don't force the breath. If you're forcing the breath, if you're trying to control the breath or working with the breath in any way, then you're creating tension in the body, so you're actually working against that internal relaxation. And when you do this, you may find that the breath varies. Sometimes the breath will be long and deep, and sometimes it'll be short and shallow, and sometimes it'll feel like you're hardly breathing at all. And suddenly you find yourself taking a large breath. And you just let all of that, because there's work itself out and play itself out. You don't try to breathe a certain way. Because all of that is the emotional material and all of that tension coming out in its own way in the breath as well as in the body. And this approach to practice is very different, for instance, from the... More common ways that Hinduism is practiced, which is to control the body and control the breath with the view to precipitating very, very particular mind states, which then are used to relax from the inside out, but it's very much a case of trying to control your experience. You learn how to do that. Very, very explicitly. In Buddhism, we put far more emphasis on just opening and letting things come out in their own way. And then the final point with respect to mind is leave your mind open. And you've heard me say this before. I mean, you can see how similar these are to the instructions I gave earlier in our class, body like a mountain, which is, you know, you can say mountains relax from the inside out, breath like the wind, completely free flowing, and then the mind is completely open, mind like the sky. So that's what is contained in the instruction, be fresh, are those 3 points. And then to be artless, to be uncontrived. In one sense, these are saying the same things in different words, very definitely. In another, it's possibly introducing another level of subtlety. As you see, it says, leave your mind as it is, as it naturally is. Okay. How is your mind naturally?
Really noisy.
Is it?
Seems like it.
Yeah. But this is the point. Most of us don't know how our mind is naturally. So read this, like, leave your mind, this is not, what's that? And we arrive at it in the same way that we've talked about many times. Yeah? Don't dwell on, don't chase after the past, don't entertain the present, don't entertain the future, don't dwell on the present, rest. And you get a taste of the mind as it is naturally there. It's just a taste. But that is the uncontrived, the artless. That's what it means to be uncontrived. Artless is just, oh. And another way this is referred to sometimes is be like a child walking into a cathedral for the first time. You know, I don't know whether you remember that. Go to some of the great European cathedrals or something like that, or Yosemite Valley does this for me too, because it's like a natural cathedral. You go. And your mind is naturally open and uncontrived. It's just like. So experiences of awe put you in touch with that. Now, it sounds absurd, of course, but this is actually the practice. Go around your life being in awe of everything. What would that be like? Certainly cut through a whole level of reaction, wouldn't it? No. Whatever arises internally and externally, you go. And you see, you're not doing anything with it. You're not trying to control your experience. So that's leave your mind as it is naturally. Leave it without it being a definable entity. Isn't that terrible? Musing me par shock. I'd probably translate these as let your mind rest naturally. Rest without identifying anything. Now, Robert Irwin, the name of his biography is Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Object that You're Looking At. So it's exactly this. It's resting without identifying anything. So just right now, just look around this room. And notice that every time you chase something, there's this little thing, oh, that's that, that's that, that's that, that's that, that's that. That's identification, okay? Now just let that go. And look around this room. And that's that, that's that, that's that. We'll probably continue going, but just let it go on, just as if it was a thought. And I think you'll find your experience shifts in a certain way. And it probably has two qualities to it. One is it's more peaceful and is less strained or struggling. Anybody find that? Okay. It's also completely terrifying. Anybody find that? A few people. Like, I'm not holding on to anything. Now, remember I've talked about jumping off the cliff? The cliff with no bottom? That's the cliff.
What's that?
I knew that I was going to provoke something.
That's the one I was asking about in the email. Seeing, did you give this to me again? Seeing is?
Seeing is forgetting the name of the object that you're... seeing is forgetting the name of what you're looking at.
Okay. So, is that maybe why the negative, what I was talking about earlier, the negative formulation that you gave, which is don't
think about that. No distraction, no control, no work.
Well, yeah. those all have a sort of, when I think of them, I want to do something. But when I work on don't think about the past, don't mm-hmm. entertain the future, don't dwell on the present, incorporated in all three of those are all the pitfalls, all distractions.
Yes.
So when I work on that, the realization that I've become distracted, I've gone away, comes much quicker and without a impulse to do anything.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah. Well, the instructions... Don't chase the past, don't entertain the future, don't dwell in the present, rest. Those instructions are designed to precipitate a shift. So experience just being, okay? The instructions, no distraction or don't be distracted, don't control your experience, don't work at anything, are telling you what to do when you've made that shift. And of course, being the rebellious person you are, he says, tell me not to do something, I'm going to do it. Well, I'm going to do something anyway. Yeah. So you can, but here they're being expressed positively. Remain fresh, artless, and unbound. And saying exactly the same thing, just different words. Okay. So, not identifying things. Now, this is a very wonderful instruction, because when you're resting in that open shift, you'll notice there's this little commentary that starts up, which says, oh, that's that, and that's that, and this is resting, this is insight. This is groovy. Okay. Those are all identifications. Okay? Now, can you stop that from happening? No, it's thoughts. Thoughts bubble up. But you can just let them be thoughts, because that's what they actually are. They're just movements in mind, they're thoughts. But what happens with those thoughts is that we don't recognize them as thoughts and we hold on to them. That's what makes them identification. And there'll be increasing levels of subtlety, but that's basically the point. Now, I mean, what happens over and over again is a student will... start doing this practice and fumble around, and then I'll have this experience of actually resting in open awareness. And of course they say, oh, this is open awareness! And of course it's gone. And so as you practice this, you begin to recognize that, oh, this is open awareness for what it actually is. Just a thought. And now you're not distracted by that thought, by holding on to it. And this is why we practice. There are many layers of working through recognitions, which we first hold on to, identification, but then we just, as we become more used to them, we just let them go on. Until we begin to get a sense of a knowing which knows without identifying. And that's when we're beginning to touch into what Mahamudra is actually about. And as that knowing becomes a constant factor, that's when we're beginning to stabilize the actual practice. And then the last way it says, you know, just rest undistracted. So those are another three instructions. And then we go over the page. And it says to be unbound, to be open. Translated this has got as accepting and rejecting. I mean, it's not wrong, but the actual Tibetan here, Gokdrup, Gok is the word to block something, to stop something. And Drup is the word to build something. So, to be open means that you don't block anything from arising, and you don't try to make, you don't build something in your practice, such as building a visualization or building a feeling or anything like that. You don't do either of those. And that's a bit strange. Probably different people have different proclivities, and some people will find it easier not to block things because they're too busy building things, and they'll find it'll be... easier not to build things because they're busy blocking everything. But if you don't do either, then, and this goes to a point that Darren was raising, you don't get to have any choice about what you actually experience. None whatsoever. Again, massively inconvenient. The third point on translation here, and this is kind of thing that I pay for. You know, I have my $5 words and $10 words. This is probably, you know, probably a $20 word. Yeah. And in Tibetan, you form abstract concepts by juxtaposing opposites. So the word for temperature, for instance, is hot-cold. And the word for distance is near far. And the height is short tall. Okay, so you get the picture. So this can be quite difficult to translate into English. In the Prayer on the Four Immeasurables, the last line, may rest in the great equanimity which is free from preference and prejudice. You had two there, Nye Ring, which was near far, which translated as preference. No prejudice. And then the other one was Chak Dong, which was attraction aversion, which translates as preference. But it only took me about 4 or 5 years to find preference and prejudice for those two things. So I'm willing to pay anybody who finds the right translation for stopping building. You know, stopping or blocking and building or making. So if you come up with a good English word for that, let me know. So that's how you rest. You rest, no blocking, no building. And of course, that leaves you totally open. And then the next instruction is making no effort. You rest. I mean, isn't this what you've always wanted, the excuse to rest without making any effort whatsoever? It's actually extraordinarily difficult for most of us. Because of these parts of us that are just working at things so hard and they just won't stop. And then the final one is letting the six senses rest naturally, or settle naturally. Now, what are the six senses? Sight, sound, or sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell. The sixth one is thinking. It's not ESP. It's not. It's the faculty of knowing, or the cognitive faculty. Now you just let that rest, settle naturally. So there you are, you're looking. Well, the first thing it means is you move into that ecstatic form, like the primary practice, where you're just open to everything in your senses. You're not holding on to this experience or holding on to this experience or trying to avoid that experience. Completely open, and open in all areas. So that's another way of thinking about opening. So you see in these three sentences, you actually end up with nine instructions. Three in each one. You can see how compact Tibetan be. And just to make his point, he now does the same thing again. Rest fresh, naturalness, wrong, yeah. Unconcerned is, it's not incorrect, but it doesn't quite work in English. And it's probably the best one can do, but it's something like, you're not calculating, you're not thinking about things, you're not working, that kind of constant appraisal process that's always going on. And here you've just let that go completely. And so that appraisal process, you know, how is this, was that good, was that, that gets in the way of being, of experiencing things completely freshly. And then this artfulness or naturalness again comes from not blocking and not building. So you're not trying to control what you actually experience. And not making any effort, told Mishower. That makes you completely open in the way that I was talking about earlier. So that sums it up. Now, it goes on and on further, taking this into all kinds of examples in the next several pages, which is what I asked you to read. But the reason I've gone over this in such detail is whether your informal meditation or in daily life, this is how to be. In formal meditation, you're practicing being this way unmixed with other activities. And there's usually plenty of us going on in our mind that doesn't feel like it's unmixed with other activities, but we do our best. And that's okay to some extent, but then we're totally open when we practice this way to all of the unresolved and unexperienced material inside us. So there will be eruptions and stuff will come up, and it happens. And that can be sometimes quite difficult, particularly if we've got stuff that we've really suppressed in us. And then there's the quite, what for everybody, are the quite shocking, or at least some people experience them as shocking, like, there is absolutely no one home. And that's very disturbing, because we think that, well, I'm here, and there we are sitting in a meditation. As we rest more and more deeply, we begin to see more and more clearly. And then you look, there is absolutely nobody there. And this raises some minor existential questions, such as, what am I? And you look, and you see, there is absolutely no one there. And so that can be very disturbing. So that's the kind of thing that can arise. I mean, it's very disturbing, it can be very freeing also, but it's also very confusing, because the fundamental fear of human existence is not of death. That's the second most fundamental fear. Fundamental fear of human existence is we don't exist. And that's actually true. We don't. And it's wonderfully ironic that in Buddhism, all schools of Buddhism, are very clear about this. You're cultivating the ability to experience what actually is, that we don't exist as such. We're experiencing what we are absolutely most afraid of. That's why it's freedom. Because we become free of that fear of non-existence. We know it's true. And not intellectually. We know it true experientially. It makes a huge difference, because now it's very difficult for somebody to insult us. And the instruction that I give everybody, you know, say, what do you do when somebody insults you? Agree with them. Yeah, because there aren't anything they say about you is as true as anything you think about yourself. Okay? You know, any conception you have of yourself is false too. Any conception that anybody else of you is false. There isn't anything there. And it's useless understanding that intellectually. You actually have to know it experientially. Now, for daily life, you do exactly the same thing. There you are, you know, washing dishes or driving or at a meeting. And there's all of the stuff and all the stimulation. And we completely forget that it's experience, and we move totally into the world that we construct from all of that stuff, which is what it means not to be present, to be asleep. We're asleep in the world of shared experience, and we're no longer aware, any significant way, of our actual world, you know, your small world, but which we agreed we wasn't so small. Yeah. Well. If you insist, Claire. So, now, what happens if you're awake in that? Well, all kinds of things cease to grab, cease to bother, cease to irritate, we stop suffering. Now, and that's what Buddhism is actually about, is ending suffering. And the nice thing about that is because when we're no longer bothered by what's arising, we stop acting in ways which bothers other people. So we end suffering, our contribution to the suffering of the world also. And this really takes a lot of practice. And there are all kinds of things you can do, but basically I want to just reiterate the point that I made earlier, that practice being woken up by what you experience. Today, I had an early morning meeting at a business that I'm doing some consulting work with, so I got over there. I got there a little bit early, which was nice. And so I was walking from one place to another, and I was very concerned about this meeting, because there was the agenda that I sent out the day before had been greeted with very little enthusiasm, in fact a certain amount of negativity. And I've known these people, I've worked with them for years, but it's, when you're the outside consultant, you're always a little nervous. Are they going to fire me now? And and so as I was walking along, I realized I'm thinking about this. And there's a stone, blade stone in front of me. I go, and then Thich Nhat Hanh's instruction says, usually we're so concerned with going with what we're going to do when we get to going from A to B. We're so concerned with what we're going to do at B that we don't experience going from A to B. I went, oh, okay. And so I just woke up a little bit right there and said, okay, I'm just going to experience the stone and the pathway and me walking, and that's fine. And of course, I became a lot calmer. And but that's what I mean about using your experience. It's a very small example, but using your experience to wake up, you know, whatever it is, use it to wake up and come right into, what am I actually experiencing now? And of course, there was all the anxiety stuff, but when I started to open to the actual physical surrounding instead of being lost in my head, then I could experience the anxiety as simply movement in mind, as and not as, oh, the whole world's going to fall apart unless I just do the right, say exactly the right thing at this meeting, et cetera, et cetera, which is usually how we're going about our lives. George.
Is that the point of the bubble practice?
Nope.
The reason I ask that is that...
This is a practice I've given George, but that's a very...
Which is imagining a bubble around yourself.
Yes.
Separating yourself from the rest of the world.
Exactly.
So isn't your awareness of what's going on in the bubble a wake-up call?
Well, yes, that is, but there are other points to the bubble practice. Okay?
Can we know them?
It's not appropriate for me to go into them. Okay. This is instruction I've given George. Okay? Anyway, we're 9:30 already. Any questions? Is this helpful, what I was talking about? Does it give you an idea? I know I've talked, and there's a lot of material to cover. Molly, there's a microphone here.
I just had a question about, I think it's in this reading, or maybe it was last week's, but purposefully bringing up the emotion.
That's when you've developed a certain amount of stability. Oh. Then you bring up the emotion so you can actually experience it as an emotion more completely. Because ordinarily, when an emotion comes up, we experience it as a fact, and it projects a world, and now we're into a totally different world, and You know, if we, anger comes up, we don't recognize anger. We just hate everything around us, and we're out to kill whatever there is, one way or another. But when you develop a certain amount of stability, then you bring anger up and you look at it, and yeah, and so now you experience it in a totally different way, because you're in a higher state of attention. And you go, oh wow, this is just, there's nothing here. It's just this rather strange movement through mind, which puts this really interesting way of looking at the world, which doesn't have any truth to it at all.
So then you're not looking at it and looking at the identity of it and watching it disappear. You're actually stimulating it to make it more there.
Yes. You bring it up, and then you experience that there's nothing. There is nothing there that is simply a way of experiencing the world, and there's no truth in that particular flavor, and no more truth in that particular flavor of experiencing the world, and that the natural awareness that is experiencing the anger isn't in any way affected by the anger. Is what I think we were talking about last week. Does what feels lonely experience loneliness? You follow?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good. One more question, Darren, and then we'll close for the evening. Microphone.
When full of dread and terror caused by magical displays of gods and demons or the like, recognize the fearful thought. Is that too big a question?
Read it again.
Where is this gods? What are the gods and demons' magical displays? Is that mistranslate?
No, 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 no. No, 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 no. Gods and demons means anything which any emotional fixation which takes over our mind, takes over our experience of the world. Okay? Now, what's the god that most people, or demon, if you wish, that most people are completely in the grips of these days?
Money.
Yeah, money, greed, whichever way you want, right? And it's just, that's it. I mean, they cannot see the world in any other terms except money. Which is really sad. For some people, it's power. Which is equally sad and equally problematic. So those are examples of two modern-day gods or demons, depending on how you want to look at them. As practice deepens and you start running into that internal material and you're relaxing very deeply inside, then you may find emotional fixations rise which just take hold of you, and they're terrifying, and they may even arise in some form in terms of visions or hallucinations and things like that, and you're going to go, what is going on? And that's where this instruction applies, that you even in those experiences, there is an awareness. There's an awareness. And you just keep coming back into that awareness regardless of what's arising. And now, all of that stuff actually heightens your experience of awareness. So it's how you use. So it's a deeper level application of what I was saying about use your experience to wake yourself up.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.